prepared to hear argument in Minnick versus Anderson. Mr. Perkins?
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Tom Perkins. I appear here on behalf of the respondent appellant in this case, Ron Landis.
Will you try to keep your voice up a little, please?
Certainly, Your Honor.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, this case presents two primary issues for this Court to resolve. The first is whether or not the District Court improperly granted relief on an equal protection claim. And the second is whether or not petitioner is entitled to relief based on his Brady claim. Now, both of these issues come to this Court with procedural baggage. With respect to the first, the equal protection claim. First, the District Court's grant of relief is based on an application of state law, that is, the Indiana state case law that determines whether or not a jury override of the a judicial override of the jury recommendation against that is appropriate. This is a matter of state law. As such, it is not cognizable in a federal habeas claim.
But you don't really mean that. I mean, if the state law had said something, which of course it wouldn't have, outrageous, like, you know, we grant habeas relief to white defendants but not to blacks, you know, that would be an application of state law, but there would obviously be equal protection overtones or glaring flaws with it. So I guess the real question is, when Judge Sharp looked at the application of state law, was there in fact an equal protection problem with the state law?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. And I would concede that there would be certain extreme examples where they support the equal protection claim. But in this case, Judge Sharp, from his order, apparently looked at three facts: that Thomas Shiro and petitioner were rapists, murderers, and were sentenced to death over a jury recommendation against them. Those are the only three factors he looked at to build a suspect class in an equal protection violation. Those facts aren't either. But more than that, he did not look behind the curtain to the actual facts that the Indiana Supreme Court looked at to apply the state standard concerning jury override. Thomas Shiro's case and William Minnick's case are not similar. Therefore, they're not similarly situated, even if rapists and murderers who are sentenced to death over a jury recognition against death can constitute a suspect class or a protected class, which, in my own knowledge, no court has found that to be true. Specifically, with respect to the differences in the cases, the Indiana Supreme Court looked at the facts in Shiro, consisting of the constellation of facts, that he admitted his crime, he was a chronic substance abuser, he was the victim of developmental abuse as a child, and he had a mental illness of long-standing duration, and a couple other facts about his case. And in that analysis, applied the state standard for jury overruns, and found that the judge improperly overrode the jury recommendation against death. The Indiana Supreme Court applied the same state law standard embodied in Martinez Chavez, as was applied to Shiro, and reached the opposite result. In essence, because none of these facts appeared in petitioner's case. While petitioner and Thomas Shiro both committed heinous crimes, Thomas Shiro had mitigation evidence available to suggest that the jury appropriately recommended the incident. Those facts were not present in the petitioner's case. Furthermore, with regard to the equal protection issue, petitioner was afforded the exact same process that Thomas Shiro received. That is, application of the Martinez-Chavez standard to judge jury overruns. So in that instance, William Minnick received the exact same protection of the law that Thomas Shiro received, albeit with a different result because of the facts of the crime.
Getting maybe slightly away, and I'm sure you have several thoughts about this, from the equal protection theory of the jury override, do you think that whatever the Supreme Court may come up with in Ring versus Arizona is going to have any bearing on your case?
If only I could foresee what Rin would say, I could answer absolutely.
We all have that problem.
Notwithstanding that.
There are similarities that have been suggested between the Indiana regime and the Arizona regime, and that's why I'm asking.
Oh, clearly, Your Honor. In fact, Arizona's scheme takes it a step further and has no jury recommendation whatsoever. To focus on Apprendi and Jones, which are the building blocks upon which Ring will be based, I see the Indiana scheme, the macro concept, being safe from application of Apprendi or Ring, whatever it says. And furthermore, in petitioner's case itself, that there will be no application, or that if Apprendi were to be applied to petitioner's case, no relief would be warranted. First of all, with respect to the scope, whatever scope Ring might have, judging from...
Can I just ask whether an Apprendi-like argument or a Ring-like argument had been made in state court here? I mean, Ring is, of course, a direct appeal, and this is a collateral attack, so there may be a procedural question as well.
There certainly are procedural issues involved, but no, Your Honor, there was no specific attack on the jury's failure to specifically find any elements beyond reasonable doubt or any sentencing issues beyond reasonable doubt. So, no, I would say that there wasn't a specific Apprendi like.
And at what time do you think we should measure this? The time of the second trial in the 80s, or the time of the direct appeal being terminated? I mean, there might be some outer limit to the foresight that we charge counsel with. And obviously it's in these briefs, but maybe that's too late. You know, I don't know. But when do you think that moment should have been?
Well, I believe that should have been all along.
Even in 1985?
Certainly for purposes of this case, with the second trial. The convictions that were filed in this case that we're looking at today, and I think instructive for that is the Teague versus Lane case, the cornerstone case on retroactivity, where Teague had raised his claim at every level, the claim that ultimately got relief in the U.S. Supreme Court, yet that was found not to be retroactive because of the application of the T and the application of retroactivity principles. I think the same thing should apply here. Even if he had raised a kindred claim or a similar claim all along, Apprendi ought not to be applied retroactively. And I think there's foundation for that in Justice Thomas's concurring opinion in Apprendi, and even in the majority opinion in Apprendi that looked favorably at Spaziano and Lee Harris, where that line of cases that allow states to develop jury recommendation law on a state-by-state basis rather than have it mandated by the federal constitution.
Let me ask you an unrelated question.
Certainly.
About the cross-appeal. Now, are you satisfied that the petitioner is not seeking a new trial?
I am not satisfied of that.
Because they say that in their surreply brief.
I believe instructive is the last line of argument in the appellee's brief, where they specifically say, based on the prosecutor's suppression of the evidence, a new trial is warranted.
Yeah, but later, I mean, they got worried about this cross-appeal point, so they say unequivocally in their surreply brief that they are not seeking a new trial, just the vacation of the death sentence and life and an order of life, asking for an order of life imprisonment. So they're not asking for an alteration of the judgment.
We are, given the substance of the cross appeal, if you will, is a Brady claim. I'm unaware of any case that would allow for a meritorious Brady claim to get relief less than a new trial.
But if they're satisfied with relief less than a new trial, you don't think they have to be forced to ask for more than they want, do you? This particular question was a question raised in the case of United States against New York Telephone, can you support your judgment with an argument that logically requires greater relief if you don't actually ask for the greater relief? And the Supreme Court answered yes. You can be illogical to that extent. Is there any problem if we understand them as just being illogical?
No, Your Honor, I guess there isn't.
Because, you see, the problem with your position is that in every case, an appellee would be open to an appellant to argue that although the appellee was purporting to defend the judgment on a different ground, really the logic of the ground that it was defending on implied an alteration in the judgment. And then we'd have all sorts of uncertainty about when a cross appeal had to be filed.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. And I think it is insightful that it has been the law of the circuit that where an athlete is arguing alternative grounds for the same relief, no cross appeal, no appeal is required. That leaves it open then to argue in the appellee's brief alternate grounds to support the district court judgment. If the cross appellant is then allowed to actually raise every issue from the district court, even claims that would extend the judgment, but simply say we're not bringing this to get more relief than was granted, we're just bringing all these other claims to support the relief that was granted, then there really isn't any incentive to file the notice of appeal.
But what's your concern in a case like that? I mean, I understand that, of course, if they want to alter the judgment, you would want to... you might present your appeal in a different way, but are you saying you're surprised that they pulled Brady out of the hat and you didn't have a chance to respond?
I guess, Your Honor, I was surprised that the Brady issue was raised in the appellee's brief.
I think I've missed a beat here. Didn't Minnick's brief make it clear to you that he was seeking to alter the judgment? You responded to those arguments.
Yes, well, I do not believe that the appellee's brief was exactly clear on what relief they sought, and that the actual prayer for relief in the conclusion was to affirm the judgment of the district court, even though the line right above it, the last line of arguments, requested a new trial. I believe that to be ambiguous. Furthermore,
well, what about the last sentence of the conclusion? The district court erred in denying relief on the grounds of the due process violations. And that portion of the court's order should be reversed. Then it does go on to say in the death sentence vacated. Well, of course, if you're going to reverse the due process violation, you're going to have to vacate the death sentence. I mean, and you certainly read that as something you had to respond to. You did.
Absolutely, Your Honor. If my memory serves, there was actually, we filed a motion to strike that portion of that brief that went beyond responding to our brief, because we did believe it to be inappropriate. That motion was denied, then we did go and answer the claims in our brief. Absolutely.
But why is
it? Whether or not we had an opportunity to respond, we absolutely did, and we absolutely took advantage of that.
I was just concerned, again, to zero in on this point. There are two possibilities, or at least there were two possibilities before the SIR reply. One of them was that this was a way of defending vacating the sentence. If the sentence of death is vacated, it's vacated. He has life imprisonment. So whether it's because of equal protection or due process or any of 100 other grounds, doesn't really matter. Those are all just alternative ways of defending the judgment. And I don't understand you to be arguing that he didn't say anything about Brady to Judge Sharp, for instance. If he's really asking for a new trial because of the Brady violation, that's a whole different question. That forces us to grapple with the cross-appeal rule, and is it jurisdictional, is it not jurisdictional? But, you know, Judge Posner points out, you know, maybe he just gave that up in the SIR reply.
That is one reading of the pleadings. Absolutely, Your Honor, that if this court will allow the appellee to I guess, waive that portion of the Brady, that portion of a meritorious Brady claim that goes to the trial, then that would resolve the notice of appeal procedural issues.
On the assumption that that might happen, you might want to address the Brady question while you have time remaining.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. Simply put, we cannot defend the first two prongs of Brady. The prosecutor absolutely had evidence intended to be exculpatory, and he suppressed that evidence at the time of trial. However, the question to resolve today, and that was resolved by the District Court and the Supreme Court, is how material that evidence was. With an eye to that, it's important to understand the chronology of events and what actually happened. The time of the first trial, there were...
Are you really saying not whether it was material, but whether the Indiana Supreme Court was unreasonable?
Yes, Your Honor, 2254.
Because they did pass on that, didn't they? I mean,
yes,
they
did, Your Honor.
Looked at it, yeah.
And the district court found that to be reasonable.
Do you think that the court, it's reasonable to assume that the course of this trial would have been exactly the same if the prosecutor had been honest? I mean, there's something profoundly troubling about sending a man to his death on the basis of lies by the prosecutor. Profoundly troubling.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And the issue there would be if the retrial were to happen today, would the outcome be any different? That is, in the Brady line of cases, the culpability of the prosecutor, as abhorrent as it may be, is not the focus.
Do you think we should notify the Indiana disciplinary authorities when prosecutors behave like this?
Certainly, Your Honor, I believe the Indiana Supreme Court, in its opinion, dealing with this issue, commented on how reprehensible this conduct was.
Let's compare the position he was in at trial with the one he would have faced if both the Brady evidence and the post-trial evidence were available. At trial, he was identified as a type O secretor, and the carpet and vaginal swabs were all from a type O secretor. Considering the Brady evidence, and the post-trial results, he's identified as a non-secretor. And the vaginal swabs and 7 out of 9 of the carpet samples are of a type O secretor, which of course her husband was. How can you argue that the non-secretor evidence is not material when it excludes him as the source of the vaginal semen in a case involving rape and murder, and it excludes him from the vast majority of the carpet stains as well?
Well, Your Honor, simply put, it does not exclude him from all of the semen stains on the carpet. And that is the same evidence that was presented at trial. That at trial was presented that, as you said, that both he and the husband were type O secretors, and that the semen stains on the carpet were from a type O secretor. So that can neither... that excluded neither the husband nor petitioner. If the evidence were to be resubmitted to a jury today, it would be that a portion of the carpet, the semen stains on the carpet, belong to a type O secretor, and a portion of it belongs to a type O non-secretor. The victim's husband was a secretor, and petitioner is a non-secretor. Therefore, it is still consistent with the theory that he left some of that semen on the carpet.
What about the vaginal semen?
I believe the evidence was mixed in terms of what semen there was in the vagina, and that one expert testified that there was no, the swabs from the vagina had no semen on them. I believe that was Dr. Pless at the second trial.
But the others were all O. The other experts testified that the vaginal semen was an O secretor.
I believe that's for sure, Your Honor.
Does the record show where these 9 pieces of carpet came from?
I can simply narrow that in the crime scene, Your Honor. I can't differentiate in terms of what parts of the house do.
Has more extensive DNA testing ever been done on the stains to resolve this matter definitively?
No, Your Honor. Petitioner has not requested such testimony.
What's the policy of the state of Indiana at this point when people do request that?
The policy of our office, which handles the capital post-conviction proceedings, including habeas, is that if the petitioner requests DNA evidence and there is sufficient biological material to test, we have no objection to that. An important thing to note here.
Would you ask for it without a request?
Would we ask for it? No, we would not. I believe that if petitioner were that confident, if a petitioner were that confident that his semen was not there.
Well, I understand the reason. I just was. Okay.
The concept that was expressed in Collins versus Whitley indicates whether there was a fair trial and verdict worthy of confidence. Given the state of the evidence today that would be submitted at a retrial, it is the same kind of evidence that was submitted at the trial that ended up with a conviction. So that verdict is worthy of confidence.
Could you remind me, I forgot now, why was his confession excluded?
I remember correctly, Your Honor, he had asked for an attorney. While he was in custody, and the attorney was not afforded.
It wasn't beaten out of him, was it?
No, Your Honor, my knowledge was not beaten out of him.
Couldn't he be heard on the tape repeatedly asking if he could leave and requesting an attorney? And then he was later questioned again without being provided that attorney. And a recording device was used intermittently and selectively, being turned off and on a number of times. Before the confession.
This is all happening at about, according to the Indiana Supreme Court, about 7 o'clock in the morning after they've picked him up at 4:45 a.m.
Yes, Your Honor, those are all facts that led to the suppression of the confession.
How old was he when he confessed?
I believe he was 18, Your Honor. He may have been older than that.
Didn't the prosecutor play a recording of the confession to the jury after the trial, and a number of them subsequently remarked to the judge that had they heard the confession, they would have imposed the death penalty, and then, of course, the judge imposes the death penalty. Isn't that the series of events?
I'm not sure that sequence of events happened before the judicial sentencing or after?
No, it happened before. The record's pretty clear about that.
I believe that would be consistent with the jury in the first trial unanimously agreeing on a death recommendation. And in any event, as has been held by this court on several occasions, including recently in cases of Nathaniel Huff, in Indiana, these trial judges and sentencers, the jury recommendation, while it is important and should be considered by the trial judge, any defects with the jury recommendation can, in essence, be deemed harmless if the sentencing judge appropriately sentences
Is the sentencing judge subject to rules of evidence in what she considers? In other words, is she entitled to consider evidence that the Indiana Supreme Court has ruled must be suppressed?
That would depend, Your Honor. And I'm not trying to be coy. There are limitations to what can be considered by the trial judge, absolutely. The victim impact evidence generally ought not be presented, things like that. To my knowledge, there's nothing specifically saying that a suppressed confession cannot be presented to a trial judge when moving to death penalty. I believe there might be circumstances where the defense could maybe open the door to something like that if, in order to present mitigation, try to claim actual innocence, residual doubt to the trial judge, that could open the door to such a confession. Having said that, in determining the sentence, anything that gives insight to the nature of the offense and the character of the offender, I believe it would be appropriate to present it. I see that I'm getting my rebuttal time at this point. No further questions. And whatever I have to do.
Thank you, Mr. Perkins. Mr. Swanson.
My name is Don Swanson, and I represent the appellee in this case, William Bennett. I think that a common thread that has run throughout this case is the prosecutor and his conduct.
Well, maybe we could straighten out this cross-appeal issue first. So you're standing by your reply brief, I take it. You're not asking for alteration of the judgment.
We are asking for a new trial.
Well, wait a second. What is this reply brief about? The SIR reply brief.
In the SIR reply brief, I did in fact indicate that we were not trying to disturb the judgment.
Right. Have you changed your mind?
Yes, we changed our mind, and in the brief that we set out the points that we wanted to reach. The principal
maybe
problem.
I have the order of these wrong. I thought the SIR reply brief was later.
You're quite correct. I was thinking of the response to the motion to dismiss.
Well, I'm completely lost now. So you filed this thing and you said you didn't want the judgment altered, and now you want it altered?
Yes. That's what
what's going on?
We're asking for relief on the Brady claim.
Well, but why did you file a SIR reply brief then? You signed it.
Well, we filed that because I was focused on the sentence of death in this case, and that I wanted to be certain that there was any chance to save Mr. Manning's life and not have the unconstitutionally infirm death sentence in this case be sustained, that we should have all of the arrows in the quiver that we could have. And obviously, that was my intention.
So that I understand it, the SIR reply brief is to indicate to ensure he would never face that again, you would not want the underlying conviction examined?
The SIR reply brief stated unequivocally that we were not seeking to disturb the judgment.
And what is the reason, may I ask, for that?
I agree with that.
You agree with what?
I agree with the SIR reply brief indicating that we did not want to disturb Judge Sharp's judgment.
So you're now asking our permission to withdraw that?
Yes, I would like to ask you permission to withdraw that. I think, again, because this is a death case, I think it's very important that some of these oversights and errors be looked through, particularly in light of, you know, the conduct of the state of Indiana.
What do you mean by not disturbing Judge Sharp's judgment? What do you mean by that?
Well, we asked for in the relief, in the third reply brief, we asked for this court to affirm his opinion. Looking at it over the past several months, it appears to me that there certainly is a significant Brady issue.
What about your client? Does your client want to risk another death sentence?
Judge, my client can't even communicate with us. He is, he's been in on X row for 20 years, and he is totally, completely out of his mind. He cannot sustain.
Then he can't be executed anyway.
I think, right.
Then he can't be executed anyway, and it's not clear why we're here if he's insane.
I don't think that.
Well, so whether he's sane or insane, the decision whether he should risk another death sentence has to be made by the client or by his guardian or someone. You, the lawyer, can't just say, "Well, we're gonna we're going to throw the dice on this. We're going to ask for a new trial, and of course, there's a big risk that he'll be, since he's clearly guilty, he's going to be convicted again. It was a horrible murder. He may well be sentenced to death again. You're making that judgment without consulting the client.
If you're asking me would I like a new trial in this case, I most certainly would.
But a new trial can lead to a new death sentence. Whereas the position you take here, when you ask for the affirmance, the obvious, there are two reasons why you might have filed this reply brief. One, because of the cross appeal concern, but the other because you'd rather eliminate all risk of a death sentence than take a chance on a new trial, which could lead to an acquittal, because after all, it wouldn't lead to an acquittal since the evidence against it is overwhelming. So I
But by the same token, if this court wouldn't entertain that one shot that Judge Sharp gave us and that we came up here on, then we would be done anyway. We could no longer raise these other issues at any higher court.
Yeah, I know. This may be a complicated tactical question. It obviously is complicated because you're going both ways. You've had trouble making up your mind. But the question is whether a decision of this court can be made by the lawyer alone and not by the client.
In terms of asking for more relief, then I guess, okay, you've indicated that he would be prejudiced if we get a new trial and then he loses if a death sentence is imposed.
Well, he may not be any worse than he is, with this appeal, but as I say, there's a judgment, and you could try to protect him against death penalty if you were very confident in your Brady claim. But did not think that the Brady claim would eventually lead to an acquittal.
In this particular instance, Your Honor, I feel that the Brady claims, I probably didn't give as much attention to them after Judge Sharp rendered his opinion.
I understood a different tactical choice underlying the cert reply brief.
I beg your pardon.
There's a different tactical choice as well underlying that choice in the cert reply brief.
Yes, there is.
The state had contended that we shouldn't consider the Brady claim at all because in your main brief you were arguing for reversal without having filed a notice of appeal.
That's right.
You filed the cert reply brief in order to ensure that the Brady claim would at least be considered in support of affirmance. And now, by changing your mind about the cert reply brief, you again raise the question whether we should consider the Brady claim at all. Is that a choice? Is that a choice that's been made by Mr. Minnick?
No, it is not a choice that
he's made. Well, according to you, based on his condition, he hasn't. I mean, have you even discussed the appeal with him, given his situation?
He cannot.
Right.
There is no
COVID
broadcast that could be.
Has he had a guardian appointed for him? Has he had a guardian appointed for him?
No, he has not.
Does the state typically do that for people on death row?
Not to my knowledge. Mm-hmm. I don't know of a single instance where they have appointed a guardian.
Are you aware of any requirement that a guardian be appointed in order for you to pursue an appeal on behalf of a criminal defendant?
I am not.
Indiana law?
I am not. I think the common thread running throughout the Brady claim is the prosecutor Brewer. I think his attitude.
But how can it be said that the Indiana Supreme Court was unreasonable in judging this immaterial in light of what we now know was the biological situation?
Well, I think that the Indiana Supreme Court's conclusion that it is immaterial when you have inconsistent serological reports that are kept from trial counsel and could have been used to impeach each report one against the other to effectively negate that type of evidence completely.
Are you saying there's evidence that there is no non-secretor semen?
There is evidence in the record of I believe three different tests. The first test was conducted. They were both determined. Minnick was determined to be a non-secretor, as was Mr. Payne. in the second test that was done just about a week before the trial and suppressed from defense counsel, it was determined that there was a secretor and a non-secretor on the carpet samples. And then there was a third test when Minnick's case was up on appeal for the second time that Brewer conducted that indicated that Minnick was a non-secretor. So given those three conflicting tests, coupled with the fact that in this case the circuit judge denied funds for an expert, which I think in essence shackled Woody Nassar, who was a trial counsel and appellate counsel in this case, I think that is a horrendous violation.
So are you suggesting, I'm trying to get a handle, as I think others are, on exactly what would have been different and why we might say the Indiana Supreme Court was unreasonable. And what I understand you'd be saying now is, why should we believe the second test that shows Payne is a type O secretor and Minnick is a non-secretor? Maybe that was done with bad protocols. If you had known about it, you could have conducted some sort of cross-examination about that test as opposed to the first test. So I understand that. I mean, expert testimony is obviously subject to attack when the experts are coming in with conflicting reports and why we assume one is true and the other isn't. Is there anything else that would have been different if, in fact, this factually different scenario had been presented as one of the possibilities to the jury? What else could have been different at the trial? Why should this undermine our confidence in the result?
Well, I think that Brady covers not only substantive exculpatory evidence, but impeachment evidence.
Oh, sure,
as well.
Yeah.
And I think that if the blood tests were completely impeached, with the state having the burden of proof and the defendant having to prove nothing, I think the case would have been crippled. There was very little other evidence after the illegal confession was suppressed, in which Brewer was instrumental incidentally in detaining Minnick and telling him it was not free to go, he couldn't have a lawyer. So I think that it would have been very, very useful, very helpful, and if not outright outcome determinative, to have that type of evidence. Because if the state then is relying to a significant degree on scientific evidence that is flawed, the jury's focus is on that flawed evidence, and therein would lie reasonable doubt in my view.
Now, you mentioned the third test in your argument, but I thought your position in your brief, but correct me if I'm wrong, was that any evidence that came in after the trial, like the third test, is completely irrelevant. In fact, you use the term freezing, that the analysis has to be frozen on the base of the evidence at the trial. Is that your position?
My position is that...
Was that the position in your brief, in any event?
Well, my position...
Because we're having a lot of changes now on arguments. So is that your position in your brief?
My position in the brief, as far as freeze-framing this Brady violation, was to demonstrate that the prosecutor had malevolent intent in this.
No, I understand that, but I'm just trying to get clear that you did take the position in your brief that third test is completely irrelevant to our consideration of the Indiana Supreme Court's consideration. Wasn't that your position?
That was my position in the brief.
And now are you changing it now?
No, I'm suggesting that.
Well, suppose we disagree with you. Suppose we disagree with you, and we think that we simply think that post-trial evidence can be considered for materiality or reasonableness. Then you lose, right? Because you don't have a backup argument. You haven't said, well, even if that evidence is admissible, it still doesn't show the immaterial. Because you don't discuss that evidence in your brief.
So you're suggesting that the third test would weaken my position?
No, I think what Judge Posner is suggesting, among other things, is one could imagine two possibilities. One, that you're standing on the argument that the only evidence that can be viewed is the evidence at the time of the trial, and that's what certainly appears in your brief. The other, and if that's all, then the question comes up, are you waiving any argument that even if the later evidence is also considered, you should still prevail? You could have argued in the alternative, you know, point one, we should look at the time of the trial, but point two, in any event, we're not making up your argument for you, but I think we do need to know what you're arguing and what is actually on the table.
Well, I am arguing that with respect to the test and the materiality of the test results, that they were material, and they were material whether there was two conflicting results or three conflicting results, they still were material, and that conflicting results were not brought to the attention of the fact finder. And I think even more egregious in this case was the fact that it was even kept from the sentencing.
But you're not responding to Judge Woods or my question. You're not stating to us, should we give any consideration to the third test, or should we simply ignore it completely because it wasn't available at the time, because it was conducted after the trial?
No, I don't think the third test should be ignored.
But in your brief, you said they should be ignored, that consideration should be frozen as of the trial. And Judge Roedner asked your opponent about, you know, the nine pieces of carpet and so on. But you've never developed an argument, have you, about the possible unreliability of the third test?
No, we haven't.
Mr. Swanson.
So really was your position that, or is your position until this oral argument, that we just shouldn't consider that third test at all? We should just look at the first two and see whether they created, you know, that those inconsistent results were material.
Well, I think that keeping the second test, my argument in the brief was keeping the second test from the defense counsel at that time was a violation of the Brady.
Right, and part of the reason you argue that is that you consider the third test, anything that happens after the trial, completely irrelevant.
Because I wanted to call the court's attention to the Brady claim, and I did not want to see conduct on behalf of the prosecutor condoned in this
Okay,
action.
But you can see, you know, you can see the argument, can't you, that however reprehensible a prosecutor's behavior, however sanctionable and however he should be punished, if we know for a certainty, to take an extreme case, we know for a certainty that his behavior couldn't have had any effect if the jury had been fully informed, then maybe reversal is the proper sanction.
Well,
it compounds the error, does it? The prosecutor misbehaves and a clearly guilty defendant gets a new trial. It's not obvious that that's a proper result.
Well, part of the problem, too, with the third test results was that it was discovered surreptitiously by the defense counsel then and then brought to the Indiana Supreme Court's attention, but he did not raise it as a Brady claim. He raised it as a newly discovered evidence claim. And I think that had that been raised as a Brady claim, at that point in time, we could have had a different ruling.
What do you mean it was brought to his attention, Mr. Swanson, surreptitiously? Wasn't there a remand from the Indiana Supreme Court and a hearing held which specifically spoke to this issue?
Yes, there was, Your Honor.
So when the appeal was taken from that decision,
right.
He was possessed, that is, appellate counsel, of the issues that would support a Brady claim, right?
When it was up on appeal, a police officer, and this is in the record, came to him and said there was a third test and you should be aware of those results. And then he contacted the then prosecutor, which wasn't Brewer, for an explanation. And then Brewer came forward with the explanation that he suppressed these results because he was fearful there was another person involved. And if he didn't suppress it, that person would be alerted and they would never make an apprehension. You know, which leads to another situation as well. Under Indiana law, that Minnick isn't solely responsible for the death in question, that also calls into question the efficacy of a death sentence in this case. Indiana law has long made the separation that where there are several responsible, the death penalty is not or may not be appropriate.
Counsel, let me take you back to the freezing question. What is your best Supreme Court authority for the proposition that a Brady claim has to be looked at solely at the evidence at the time and that it is not permitted to look at any evidence gleaned subsequently? I ask that because you rely on some Seventh Circuit cases, but under the AEDPA, on collateral review, we're not supposed to be looking at our own cases. We're supposed to be looking at Supreme Court cases.
That's
correct. So my question to you is, what's your best Supreme Court authority for the freezing principle?
Mr. Swanson, are you aware of any case where a court has found a Brady violation that is not excusable as harmless error, where the relief granted is anything short of a new trial?
I believe that there are two concepts involved there with respect to a Brady claim. I think that there could be a situation in a Brady claim where the prosecutor's conduct is so egregious and is so continuing that you would not have to show that the Brady evidence would have changed the outcome. I believe that's back.
Mr. Swanson, is it your position that is it your belief that the reason Brady wasn't raised after the remand is because of this need for the third test, that there wasn't sufficient evidence of a Brady violation unearthed on the remand hearing?
Well, I think that Woody Nassar and the prosecutor Brewer was a smaller county, and they were good friends, and he didn't want to raise the specter of prosecutorial misconduct. So we thought it would be just as well to raise it as newly discovered evidence.
Would you give me the procedural history of where the case was tried originally and where it was tried on remand?
The case was tried in Terrebonne, Louisville County.
And the crime was committed in Greencastle, right?
Yes.
They took it a change of venue down
That's
to
Vigo. Right.
That's the first trial?
That's the first trial. And the second trial, I'm not sure where it's
Lawrence County, Bedford, or in Judge Cheesham tried it.
I'm not sure where the county.
But the original prosecutor stayed with the case up to what point?
Lawrence. He stayed with the case throughout the proceedings.
Through both trials, the first trial, yes. Second trial?
Yes, he did both trials.
And what about on the appeal? The Attorney General became involved at all?
Again, in both appeals, it was the Attorney General who would step aside.
In fact, the Attorney General in Indiana, the Attorney General takes control of the case on appeal.
Of all appeals, yes. I'd like to answer one other question, too, that was posed to me, and that is, if we do win a new trial, what about the specter of having a death sentence reimposed? The Indiana legislature now has passed a bill, the Senate has passed a bill doing away with judicial override. If that passes the House, then that will become the law of the land, and that will favor Minnick, I think, in terms
of... Not necessarily. The next jury may unanimously recommend that penalty.
But at least you wouldn't have to fight both battles.
Did you discuss the standard of the Anti-Terrorism Effective Death Penalty Act in your brief?
I No, we did not.
I'm wondering how you respond to Judge Easterbrook's question, that if you're making an argument that isn't based on a Supreme Court decision, you just don't have a claim, no matter how good a claim it might be in a direct appeal.
Well, with respect to that, we did raise the Brady versus New Jersey's
claim. Well, no, I'm thinking about the Brady. Well, maybe Brady isn't your main claim.
Well, Brady versus Maryland is a Supreme Court case.
No, but the issue is the whether you evaluate materiality on the basis of just evidence in the trial, whether you can look at evidence obtained later. Important issue given the length of the review proceeding, the process in death cases.
I don't think you have to reach that in a Brady situation, whether or not there's...
I know that's your position, but if your position has no support because the Supreme Court has never addressed the question, how do you get to first base under the anti-terrorism statute?
I suppose if we're denied relief here, we will go to the Supreme Court.
I don't think that's quite how it works. But.
My opponent indicated that he did not think that Apprendi versus New Jersey would effectively do away with Indiana's death penalty, and I would respectfully disagree with him on that in that regard. When Minnick was tried, the death sentence was imposed. The Indiana law was a term of years, 60, up to 60 years of the murder. In addition, the jury would have to then reconvene and entertain the death sentence and review various aggravators in order to enhance the sentence from that term of years to the sentence of death. And I believe that Apprendi stands for that proposition that where the state is seeking more than the maximum under the statute, and the statute in this case is the murder statute, because the death penalty statute is a separate and distinct statute, then the jury must decide that question. And I think that would, in Minnick's case, would help a great deal to avoid the death sentence in this case.
Well, the maximum the jury could impose would be death as well, isn't it? I mean, they have the opportunity to impose a death penalty.
They have the opportunity, but the murder statute says, is cited in one section of our code, and we have a bifurcated proceeding, and under the second, another section of our code is the death penalty application. So what I am saying is,
can the trial judge override a jury recommendation for death and impose life imprisonment?
Now?
Under the existing law. In other words, is the judge's override a two-way street, or can the judge only go to death from a life imprisonment recommendation?
Yes.
The judge certainly can do that, which we've seen in many cases. Sure. But if the jury recommends death, then is it automatically death? Or can the judge say,
I think mitigating factors. Right, the judge can override.
So either way. Okay. So the judge has the final decision in all death penalty cases about whether the sentence will be death or some, you know, life imprisonment or
term of years. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Swanson. Mr. Perkins.
Thank you, Your Honor. Briefly, I have four things I'd like to say as well. First, on the direct appeal, 544 Murphy, second 471, it points out that the 1982 trial was in Clay Circuit Court and the retrial was in Warrenton. Given the change.
Same prosecutor and same defense counsel followed the case.
I know it was the same prosecutor. I believe it was the same defense attorney, although I'm not sure. The circuit precedent is clear that you're asking for relief greater than that in given the district court, I know this appeal is necessary. In the habeas context, I submit that we should fit through the appeal board, should also necessary to help.
Is it your view that by asking for greater relief, you knock out the possibility of using a ground in defense of one's judgment? That is, if it's established in, say, the New York telephone case, that you can urge a ground illogically in support of one's judgment, why should it be the case that by asking for greater relief, you knock out that use? And that's effectively the position taken in your brief, and I'm not sure I understand why that should be so.
Your Honor, I believe, if it were otherwise, there really would be no bar to bringing everything that was raised in the district court in the appellate brief.
But what's wrong with that?
What's wrong with it?
Judgment. If all you're trying to do is support the judgment, and you have, in fact, presented it to the lower court, that's what we do.
Indeed, if you only seek to further support for the judgment, then there really isn't a...
Right, but that's my question. If the appellee's lawyer then gets over-enthusiastic and says, and reverse too, your position is that suddenly you can't use it even as support for affirmance, and I don't see why. Unless it's just some kind of booby trap for lawyers. They have to watch very carefully where they're walking. One false step and they slide down this chute and end up outside the building.
I believe my position is that the rules are there for a reason. Congress and the United States Supreme Court will freely enforce.
Yeah, but see, the question is how the rule is enforced. One way to enforce it is just say, well, if you didn't file a cross appeal, you can say anything you want, but we're not going to alter the judgment. So we'll consider your arguments, for whatever relief you might, alternative relief, not involving alter. In other words, we'll consider whether your arguments are good, but you can't get the judgment altered. You can just get it affirmed. That's your only remedy. That would be a little less drastic.
That certainly may be disappointing to appellees, but that does seem...
Could I just ask you, do you have any comment on this question of Mr. Minnick's mental state and whether he can consult with lawyers and whether insane people on death row get guardians?
I have no independent knowledge, and there's nothing in the record to support those statements. With regard to guardianships, I am familiar with the case of Charles Roche, who in the district court was trying to waive his appeals. A guardian was appointed, actually, with a situation developed where he married someone so that she could file a habeas petition on his behalf that he then adopted. There are mechanisms in place in Indiana for guardians to be appointed.
So prisoners aren't ineligible.
Absolutely not.
There was the case you're referring to, there was a guardian appointed prior to his marriage?
I believe not, Your Honor. I believe the marriage was so that she could be made the guardian. Very quickly, with respect to Apprendi, the murder statute in Indiana says that it's by the term of years, and then the same statute, I believe it's subsection B, says that if certain other aggravators are proven in accordance with this other, with the death penalty statute, that death penalty and LLOP are available. Therefore, I submit that the maximum statutory sentence in Indiana for murder is death with these other aggravators. Having said that, in this case, petitioner was convicted at the guilt phase of rape and robbery, which were also the death penalty aggravators. So there is a finding by a jury beyond reasonable doubt that he committed those facts, or the facts are present that support the death penalty.
Mr. Perkins, I don't know that it matters, but my recollection of the Roche case is that Mr. and Mrs. Roche were married before she became his guardian.
That's my recollection too, Your Honor. And if I said something different from that earlier,
A long time before she became his guardian. I thought you said they were married so that she could become his guardian, but I didn't think that.
Thank you, Mr. President. We thank all counsel. The case will be taken under advisement, and the court will stand in recess.